Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. To friends, ex-friends, students, allies, enemies known and unknown, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is once again your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 9th of January, 2014. This is Nav Briefing number 102, Kali's Magic Moment. Now, I'm recording this briefing to follow up as rapidly as I can on the previous briefing entitled The Will to Avenge. I felt rather uncomfortable after posting that briefing about some points of style and perhaps also content that might appear to be objectionable. You know, there are some things that I do and say that I even find objectionable sometimes. I felt that some of my language in that briefing was borderline, and I'd like to be extremely careful and call upon your patience to qualify some things I said, and also to clarify and sharpen some of the critical points that I made in that briefing. So the great bulk of this briefing will be dedicated to doing just that, and to returning to the subject of the wounds of the mother and the harm to the child. But before I launch into that, I'd like to mention three current items which have come up lately on the screen, which I find worthy of notice to the crew. I received a couple of emails recently from Terry Cole Whitaker. I don't know if that name rings a bell to any of you. The last name is spelled C-O-L-E hyphen W-H-I-T-T-A-K-E-R. And I've known of Terry, haven't met her personally, but I've known of her for a good many years. And I often cite the title of her first book, which came out in 1979, which is What You Think of Me Is None of My Business. Or to put it in French, Qu'est-ce que tu penses de moi, ce n'est pas mon affaire. And I have always found that title and that line to be a striking line and a sober message that clears the air nicely when the air needs to be cleared. Of course, you could also turn around the syntax and you could say, what I think of you is none of your business. Qu'est-ce que je pense de vous? Ce n'est pas votre affaire. And that also is a good rule to clear the air. What I think of you is none of your business, unless you choose to make it your business. And if you choose to do so, well, good luck. I thought it was good to hear from Terry, and she surprised me by saying that she follows Planetary Tantra and some of the GNE instructions, as far as I can tell. And I was delighted when she informed me that she also was born on December 3rd on the Aldebaran on Terry's axis. So that was a lovely note coming to me across the planet recently. The other two points concern perhaps, let's say, issues of synchro mysticism. I would apply that phrase, issues of synchro mysticism, to those occasions when something occurs in the news or a development or event occurs in the world at large that coincides with something I'm discussing in a briefing. And it coincides both in theme and material as well as in timing. So, you know, I spoke of Baphomet recently in the briefing on the satanic narrative. Big, big subject, Baphomet. Much discussed on the internet. It's the boogeyman that people haul out of the closet, and of course it's always Christians that haul it out, and prop it up on stage and point to it and say, this proves that there are people worshiping Satan and worshiping the devil. And so I have yet to find, among the various internet documentaries and YouTube clips treating Baphomet, any single instance when the individuals discussing that symbolic figure actually know what they're talking about, or when they actually refer to any sources that would be original sources in ancient times, or to any valid critical analysis of those ancient sources. No one except myself is speaking from any kind of informed scholarship about the significance of Baphomet. Anyway, I'm speaking of Baphomet. What was it, last week? And suddenly a big news item comes up that some satanic group, the Church of Satan, has proposed that a statue of Baphomet with two children standing beside it ought to be erected somewhere in Oklahoma in front of some courthouse. And this is a tit-for-tat gesture, apparently, because people from the Christian right were able to have a replica of the Ten Commandments erected in the courtyard of the courthouse or whatever. And so the representatives of the Church of Satan, whoever they may have been in this case, came forward and said, well, it's a free country and all religions should be equally represented, so we want, here's a maquette of the statue of Baphomet. And a number of people have commented on this, of course. It's a pretty sensational news item. I tend to think that it's rather a joke. I'm not sure. But even Brian Gerrish, whom I watch on UK Column, brought up this item, opening up one of his recent broadcasts. And unfortunately, as much as I respect Brian for the work that he does in exposing the Saul Alinsky behavioral modification tactics that are being used to destroy the United Kingdom, and for his great dedication to the cause of systematic child abuse, he doesn't know anything about ancient material either. He doesn't know anything about the history of religions, the history of Satanism, what is Satanism, what is the spectrum of Satanism from, say, a serial killer like Richard Rodriguez, all the way over to Zina LaVey and the other daughter of Anton LaVey, whose name is Carla LaVey. I think I mistakenly said Laura LaVey. So put the LaVey children, who are articulating the principles of Satanism, at one end of the spectrum, and at the other end of the spectrum, put demented serial killers like Richard Rodriguez, who claim to be Satan worshippers and who perhaps have had visits from an hallucinatory figure of Satan or whatever, and actually do murder and dismember and torture people and carve pentagrams on them or whatever, and evaluate the meaning of Satanism by standing back and looking at the spectrum. So Brian Gerrish doesn't do that, and he doesn't have the training or the background or the scholarship to do that. And so he implies, oh, well, yes, children should be taught the principles of Satanism, and, you know, wouldn't that be terrible? Well, what are the principles of Satanism, Mr. Gerrish? Where do you get your profile of Satanism from? If you get it from Christians, you're getting it from the wrong source, because they invented Satan in the first place. I can't say that too many times. I think it's most amusing that the ninth principle or proposition of the Satanic Church founded by LaVey says that Satanists are grateful to the church because the church should be grateful to Satan, excuse me, because Satan has kept the church in business all these years. So What do we see around this item regarding the erection of this statue of Baphomet in Oklahoma? We see the usual confused and distorted discourse. We see the complete absence of any actual scholar such as myself who could allude to the Dead Sea Scrolls, who could allude to the Nag Hammadi material, or who knows anything about the history of magic and witchcraft and its repression through the Middle Ages. It's really shocking, it's shameful and pathetic that there's a total lack of intelligent debate about the subject of Satanism on this planet. But the subject is not going to go away, obviously. So that was a little bit of synchro mysticism. And thirdly, I would point out that I received a couple of days ago an email from my Sicilian ally, Luciano, who lives in Messina, which is on the Straits of Messina, connecting Italy and Sicily. Luciano was responsible for finding the Italian publisher Uno Editore for Not in His Image. As you may recall, Not in His Image came out in Italian translation in April of last year. At that moment, the internet featured photos of a V-shaped formation of lightning hitting the dome of the Vatican. I don't recall the exact publishing date of the book in the month of April, but it was very close to the date when Pope Benedict resigned. So there was an event that there was some more synchromysticism, if you want to read it in that way. Have to be careful of human self-importance and over-attribution. It would be unfortunate to miss these synchro-mystical events when they happen, but it would be equally foolish to over-determine them. So one walks a fine line in discussing this subject. But anyway, those events did happen in the month that my book came out. And you may also recall that I pointed out that not too long after the book had been out, that is to say, it had been displayed in bookstores around Italy, and if it was displayed with the cover outward, then the word Gnosticism would have been seen by people walking among the aisles of the bookstore. And so it was not too long after the book was in the bookstores that the new pope, I guess he's called Francis, gave a sermon that was translated simultaneously into 87 different languages. It was a Sunday sermon that he gave before the cardinals, in which he spoke the G word. He actually said Gnosticism and Gnostics. And he actually said that they were right and that they had a direct path to divinity, but that it was dangerous because it did not go by the way of sucking the pus out of the wounds of Jesus, which is the best way to know the flavor of the divine, according to the Catholic Church. So it was remarkable indeed, and I do credit it to the presence of my book in the Italian world and the introduction of the dreaded G word on the cover of my book. It was remarkable that the Pope even mentioned the Gnostics, because it's a highly taboo subject. And speaking of the Gnostics raises the risk of opening the question in people's minds. Well, who were these Gnostics and what happened to them? And of course, until this day, the Catholic Church, although it has disingenuously apologized for a great many things, has not, as far as I know, apologized for the genocide of the shamans and witches and midwives of the Middle Ages in the great witch hunts, nor has it apologized for the obliteration of the pagan mystery schools and the Gnostics. So come ahead now to a third event relating to that fuzzy and funny and lovely little topic, Catholicism. In this mail of January 8th, Luciano informs me that the Pope, quote, continues the Christian co-optation of ancient pagan knowledge. The photos divulged in the Italian media show him with a little lamb on his shoulders, and he gives me a link to this photo, end quote. Does that image remind you of anything? A man with a lamb on his shoulders. Well, Luciano goes on in this letter, which is forwarded to the Italian publishers, or CC'd to my Italian publishers. He goes on, quote, as John Masterly explains in Non a sua immagine, the image of a little lamb is a pagan symbol co-opted by Christian followers. See at the chapter 20, the section Il Buon Pastore. And then he quotes from chapter 20 of Not in His Image. At the dawn of the Piscean Age, pagan initiates in the Near East faced an unprecedented challenge: how to present the Anthropos in a public or popular manner in order to counter the growing popularity of the Christian Redeemer, the God-man, Jesus Christ. Thinking along mythological lines, Syrian Gnostics from Antioch decided that a much-loved figure from ancient Middle Eastern mythology, Tammuz, would be an appropriate stand-in for the Anthropos, true humanity. Tammuz was the divine shepherd, a lover of the great goddess Ishtar, equivalent to the Greek Aphrodite. But with the suppression of goddess religion under patriarchy, Tammuz had fallen into relative obscurity and his pagan identity had come under taboo. The Antioch cell conceived of reintroducing him in the guise of the Good Shepherd, renamed Hermas. Some representations of Hermas survive. They show a strong but gentle young man, smiling broadly, standing upright, with a lamb across his shoulders. This image was not original with the Antioch cell. Its prototype can be seen in Hermes Creophoros, the ram-bearer, an ancient divinity of the Pelasgians, the indigenous pre-Hellenic people of the Peloponnesus. But the initiates altered the original figure by replacing the ram with a lamb. This was to be the symbol chosen to mirror humanity in the Piscean Age. And final paragraph from Not in His Image, quoted in Luciano's email, goes like this. The Gnostic figure of Hermas, considered by the Antioch cell, never emerged because it was cleverly co-opted by a proto-Christian group in the same city. Yet again, counter-mimicry came into play. Around 150 CE, the Antioch congregation, the first group known historically to call themselves Christians, see Acts 11:26, produced a book entitled The Shepherd of Hermas, attributed to the brother of Pius, then Bishop of Rome. And the rest is history. And the rest is predictable. So I find it rather remarkable that the co-optation that took place in 150 CE, Common Era, or 150 AD, if you wish, the co-optation of the telestic image of Hermas as a man with a lamb across his shoulders to represent the Anthropos has been repeated today in 2014 by the Pope posing and posturing for the Italian media with a lamb on his shoulders. Well, I leave you to read that incident according to your own Gnostic acumen. I'll remind you that I said in July of 2013 that we had entered the Gnostic moment. That was a couple of months after the book came out in Italy, and very close to the time of the Pope's sermon mentioning the G-word. The Gnostic moment was indicated as the moment when the lunar apogee reached 1 degree of Cancer, 1 degree of the astrological sign Cancer. That position corresponds in the real sky zodiac to the feet of the twins. And as I pointed out back then in July, there is a factor, a point in the structure of the solar system located exactly there at the feet of the twins, namely the perihelion of Saturn, which I determined years ago in Los Angeles during my studies with Vili Sukkar, represents the Gnostic impulse operating through millennia of time. So when, in my decoding of the celestial writing, I determined that the convergence of the lunar apogee at that point, the perihelion of Saturn, indicated that we entered the Gnostic moment. I would say that we're still in the Gnostic moment, and that we may well be in the Gnostic moment for a long time to come. And I'm really encouraged by the news of these photographs of the Pope with a lamb on his shoulders. It tells me how close the two sides are coming as the battle lines are formed. You could imagine the Pope standing there in front of the world, and all the cameras are on him. Of course, business as usual. But what the cameras don't see is myself standing about 8 feet in front of him and breathing in his face. So this is how close it's getting in the Gnostic moment. This is how close it comes as the battle lines close for the engagement to come. And that would be, as you know, the moment of the engagement of the Kalika War Party. We are still in this turbulent and precarious moment, my friends. The Kalika War Party has not failed, and no Gaian warrior, to my knowledge so far, has failed his or her mission. Why not? Including myself. Why not? Because we are making the formation prior to the attack. And in this precarious and turbulent moment, there is bound to be some drop-off in the GNE, a trimming down of the ranks that's required so that when the full Kalika War Party stands in formation, there is not one single individual in the party who will flinch and who will relent or hesitate to proceed into the thick of the battle. While I'm on this subject, let me add one more key strategic point to your understanding of the Kalika War Party. I know that there are people out there in the world, some of them allies of mine, some of them not allies, some of them indifferent to me, perhaps some of them even hostile to me, who have been engaged already in their life in a Kalika-type war against the system that is bent on destroying life on this earth, the system that destroys the life of nature, of the plant world, and the system that destroys humanity and everything that is sane and good in the social order and in the organizations of mutual aid. I know that there are warriors out there, warriors and teachers, like Terry Cole Whitaker and others who have already been there for 30, 35 years, in the battle lines and have fought for Gaia and fought for the Earth and fought for sacred ecology. And I am not discounting in any way or overlooking the valiant and heroic efforts of such people. But what you must understand about the Calico War Party is this. It operates as a unity. It operates as a single and unified band of 16 components. And so those warriors for Gaia who have already put in a lot of dedication and a lot of time and risked their lives and their fortunes must certainly be recognized, and I regard them with the highest respect. Believe me, I do. But the full-blown, full-scale battle has yet to occur. And in the formation of the Calico War Party, I would invite you to consider that there is an integrity among the warriors that has not yet ever been achieved on this planet. An integrity and a solidarity in that formation. And that formation is building strong as I speak. It's coming around. It requires, as you know, a more cogent and well-measured balance between the male and the female participants. We don't have that balance yet. I myself have contributed to the imbalance by my deference to women and my tendency to elevate the feminine over the masculine. But now, with Saturn at the fulcrum of the scales, for most of 2014, the moment of balance and equilibrium between the genders comes. And this balance of genders gives great force and cohesion to the warrior party. Neither male nor female opinions dominate in this party. Do you understand that? We all stand by the same standard. Men and women all adhere to the same standard, which is the double standard of total transparency and the agreement to have differences without conflict. So the Warrior Party is something quite special. It is a configuration that has never existed before on this planet. It is deeply rooted in the vision of the Sophianic narrative. It is the social activist expression of planetary Tantra. And all warriors who have made their mark in the world until today are invited to this formation. Or, if they wish, they may continue to fight their chosen fight on whatever front they may stand, in complete independence from the Calico War Party. If you have already defined your role and your mission to protect the Earth and fight against the insanity and predation that threatens life on this planet, then you don't need to find your position among the ranks of the Calico War Party, do you? There is no contradiction between individual Gaian warriors and those who belong in the ranks. They coexist, and may I ask if that could be a peaceful coexistence. So with that much prefatory comment out of the way, I'd like to go directly now back to some statements that I made in the last briefing. I was almost inclined to take that briefing offline, but I hesitated because, well, you know, I don't pretend to be impeccable. And sometimes I do things which are almost objectionable to myself. And as I listened to the last part of that that briefing, I found that my use of certain terms and certain assertions was really questionable. So let me see if I can readdress that. Let me see if I can restate some things and clear up what might be negative or unfortunate inferences drawn from my words. So in the first place, I'd have you recall that I said, when someone hurts me, I have the impulse to hurt them in return. Now, of course, that is a statement, a proposition, a stance totally opposed to the Christian ethic attributed to Jesus. This is not a turn-the-other-cheek philosophy. I think it's interesting that if you listen to Zena LaVey talking about the principles of Satanism, you'll find that she addresses the turn-the-other-cheek ethic of Christianity and refutes it in the same manner. So you could say that I have something in common with the intellectual and ethical argument of certain Satanists when I reject the idea that if someone hurts me, I should turn the other cheek and let them hurt me again, and then I should even be kind to them and love my enemies and anyone who wishes me harm. So it ought to be clear to all of you who know me a little bit, and here I'm stating the obvious, that I'm not a guy who loves my enemies and forgives them and wishes to have them hurt me even more by turning the other cheek. Certainly not. But when I come right out and say, when someone hurts me, I feel like hurting them in return, it sounds a little scary and, you know, rather nasty. So let me qualify that statement. There is a compulsion, which I think is natural and healthy in the human animal, to fight back. There is a natural instinct to defend oneself in the human animal, as there is in all other animals on this planet, from my cat Rumi, who's down here eating his lunch, to an ant, to an elephant, to any animal you name, to a fish, to a spider, will defend themselves when another creature is harming them or threatening to harm them. And yet, in the human animal, that natural compulsion is measured by the voluntary nature of human consciousness. One of the factors that makes the anthropine animal different from the feline or the equine animal or the canine animal is that the anthropine always has the capacity, the anthropine is endowed with the capacity to introduce a voluntary control element to its own instinctual programming. So I have an instinctual programming, which I call the will to avenge, that is to say, to strike back against someone who harms me. But additionally, I also have the voluntary component that I add to that out of my consciousness, or conscience, if you will, which is unique to the human animal. So it's not instinct against morality. It's not being an animal, being like an animal against acting like a real human being. It's about acting like a real human animal. And when I act like a real human animal in a situation where someone hurts me, either by a physical action, which is extremely rare, or by words and deeds directed toward harming me or harming my way of life, I have three options I can take. Even though I may strongly feel the compulsion to strike back, that is to avenge, I always face three options. For instance, first, I can just let it go by, and I most often do. I would say that in more than 50% of the cases where someone harms me or speaks against me, which is generally the way it's done, makes a case against me, accuses me of things that I've done, which I haven't done, then I let it go. I don't strike back in return. The second option I have is to respond to the harm directed toward me, or an attack on my character, or on my work, for instance, in a kind and sober way. That is to say, to just respond without aggression, and to actually show compassion and kindness toward the person who is attacking me or attempting to hurt me in some way. And I've done that off and on. I can do that. It's a choice. There's always a choice to be kind, but it is a choice. And likewise, not to be kind is a choice. So if I act or react in a brutal and unkind way towards someone who harms me, it's a choice that I make. And I make that choice to strike back on some selective occasions. And I would say of those three options, that is the option that I least tend to take. Or more accurately, I would say, to respond with kindness and to strike back are two options that I tend to take more or less in equal measure. But most of the time, more than half of the time, I just let it go by. So I am not some kind of monster who gleefully and eagerly seizes upon the opportunity to strike back at someone. I do it with a great deal of deliberation. Before someone feels the lash, you can be sure that I have really scrutinized myself and scrutinized the situation I'm facing. And when I strike out, I do so with a deliberate intent, which is not merely to harm another person, but to reach that person through what are considered to be negative and transgressive emotions, such as contempt, scorn, and anger. As far as I'm concerned, from a tantrical point of view, emotions are just handles to me. You know, when you roll up the window of a car, you need a handle because the window of a car is concealed down inside the door. And it would be very inconvenient to reach down with your fingers and grapple for the edge of the window and pull the window of the car up with your fingers. So there is conveniently a handle attached. You crank the handle and it raises the window. An emotion is just a handle. If I want to raise a reaction in you, I just crank a handle. I can crank the handle of tenderness, the handle of flirtation. I can crank the handle of admiration, the handle of praise, the handle of gratitude. Or I can crank the handle of contempt. I can crank the handle of anger. I can crank the handle of humiliation. It's all the same to me. Emotions are just tools to reach another human animal. Now, what I'm talking here is actually a tantric viewpoint of the use of human emotion. And it goes a little beyond the context in which I originally began. So I'm going to return now to the limited context in which I am attempting to correct or clarify and qualify some things that I have said in that previous briefing on the will to avenge. Now, in that briefing, I used the word brutalize, and I said that I brutalize people on occasion. You know, brutalize is a Kalika term, of course, because brutality is a Kali motif, you know. Kali is brutal, but Kali is also really tender. And unless you are inside of Kali's own skin, it is difficult, if not impossible, to see that the brutality and the tenderness come together and arise from the same root. To adopt the Buddhist jargon, brutality and tenderness are co-emergent in the style of Kali. And that is extremely difficult to see if you are someone who is targeted by that style. When I use the word brutalize, I want you to understand what I mean by that. I've spoken about my experience in the recovery movement. I think I should speak about it more in upcoming briefings. I'm seeing now that my experience in that movement during the 1980s and 90s proves to be highly relevant to the strategies of the Kalika War Party today. So I would like to bring forward, as appropriate, the tools and insights that I drew from recovery and share them with you today, some 25 years later. One of the things that I learned in recovery that was immensely valuable to me was how to express my anger without being abusive. There's a difference between abusive language and genuine, honest expression of anger. They are not the same. And I assure you, my friends, that learning the difference and learning how to practice and express pure anger non-abusively is an art, and it is not easy to learn, and it is not easy to do, and I don't do it impeccably, but I do know something about how to do it. I'm not going to go into the particulars of the tools right now, for instance, using I statements rather than you statements, but I will just point out that the genuine expression of anger is extremely important for healthy relations between human beings. Alice Miller and others pointed out, particularly I think it was Virginia Satir and other teachers of developmental psychology who were regarded as gurus in the recovery movement, John Bowlby on object relations and so forth, pointed out that the child growing up, the age of 2, 3, 4, needs to be able to express its anger toward its primary caretaker in confidence that it will not lose the love of the caretaker. If a child cannot release its natural anger in the security of knowing that it will not lose the object of its love to whom the anger is directed, then that child is in deep trouble as a child and will be in deeper trouble later on in life. And yet today I find that it is nearly impossible to find myself in a situation where the expression of anger is acceptable. The expression of anger must be acceptable among the members of the Kalika Warrior Party, just as a categorical principle, but then the art of expressing anger in a non-abusive way is something that has to be learned. So when I brutalize, I mean that I'm expressing my anger in a way that is non-abusive, but it is still hurtful. Can you see the difference between that? Certainly it's going to hurt the feelings of the person. But the intention of the hurt is not abuse. The intention of the hurt is to avenge and to reach that individual by the emotion expressed. And anger is a great way to reach people. The problem is, of course, that when you use anger on people, you reach them and then they turn away and they never want to talk to you again. Needless to say, there's a risk in this tantric style of handling emotions. You got that, right? It can be destructive. That's a risk you take. It's a risk I take. I'm not going to say it's a risk you take. I do not wish to impose my style on anyone. And I do not wish to suggest to you, by any kind of inference, that in listening to me talk in this manner, as I occasionally do in these briefings, that you are in any way obligated to emulate me or to even accept what I do or to find it as acceptable, what I do and say. It may be completely unacceptable. And if so, that's fine too, because one of the standards by which we now operate is that we can accept differences without conflict. Get my drift? Finally, to close off this topic, because in the remaining half hour I want to return to the subject of Kali's magic moment, it would be important not to omit the use of abusive words. Now, I have learned not to use abusive words. So when I brutalize, quote, unquote, someone, I do not use abusive words against that person. That is to say, name calling. You know, it's very common to swear and to use the word, you know, bitch and cunt as abusive terms. I would never use those terms abusively. In fact, I love the word cunt, and I think it's a beautiful and tender word that ought to be used only playfully and in delight and in reverence. I would not use the word bitch, because bitch refers to the infernal powers of the underworld, and I love those bitches, and I would only use the word bitch toward a woman as a compliment. In fact, the strongest word of abuse that I would ever apply to a woman is twat. That's about as strong as it gets. And the strongest word of abuse I would ever apply to a man is wimp. And that's it. Part of the art of expressing your anger honestly to another person, nakedly and honestly and transparently, not pretending that you're not angry, not pretending that you assume a posture so that you look good. The art of doing that requires not using the abusive terms that normally spill from people's mouths. So I just want you to know for the record that twat and wimp are about the heaviest words that I would ever use in the act of verbal retaliation. And so, to conclude this topic, let it be known to the world, if you don't know already out there, that I do retaliate, and I will hurt the feelings of someone who has hurt my feelings. Primarily, the way to do this, of course, is through words, and through the use of language in a way that can be brutal and scathing, but not abusive, because the intention is not to abuse. So vengeance is not abuse. It is the proper and natural response to being hurt or harmed. I would say, and this brings me back to the theme of Kali's magic and Kali's message. Would you like to hear a message from Kali? Well, listen to this. Be ruthless first in self-love. That's a Kalika instruction. Be ruthless first in self-love. Emphasis on the word first. In my psychology, in my understanding of human relations, drawn not only from my testimonial experience in those recovery rooms, by which I mean sharing my story and listening to others share their story, and in addition to my studies of the developmental psychology, the child psychology, the object relations theory, etc., etc., that formed the infrastructure of the recovery movement, well, based on all that, I have to say that I consider the will to avenge to be a healthy and normal expression of self-love. And so be ruthless first in self-love. Don't feel guilty or ashamed if you strike back at somebody who's harming you. Learn how to do it skillfully and artfully and impeccably so that it can really feel good to do that. And don't make excuses for it. There is so much to learn about the Kalika way of life for those who are compelled or attracted now to enter the formation of the war party. So much to learn. Well, I, for one, regard this as an exciting moment to learn and to formulate the ethics and the tactics of human-animal behavior. As I've said, Saturn hovers around the fulcrum of the scales for a good part of the year 2014. That's where it is right now as I speak. And I read this sign in the sky as an omen of timing. It tells us that the moment has come to look at the fulcrum of Gaian ethics. And what is that fulcrum? Well, it better be in your own personal ethic and in your own emotional style of expression. The fulcrum must be planted or grounded in your emotional style of expression, including the expression of what are considered to be negative and transgressive emotions, such as anger. Well, enough said on that. Let's get back to that poster that accompanied the previous NAV briefing. I'll read again what it says. Hurt the mother, the wound she'll take, but hurt the child, and Kali awakes. As I pointed out before, these four lines, broken into two parts, address actually two very different matters facing us in the world today. The first is the matter of the harm done to the planet Earth. As I've said, it has been since the 1960s highlighted by Rachel Carson's book, The Silent Spring, that some people on this planet have become deeply concerned about pollution and damage to the environment, damage to the oceans and the air, and have taken a stance in the war of ecology and in the ecology movement, which unfortunately was very early subverted and hijacked by Maurice Strong and other nefarious globalist predators. Nevertheless, the spirit of protection of the earth is still strong, stronger than ever. And indeed, we find that the ecological crisis, the ecological catastrophe signaled by Rachel Carson, has accelerated exponentially since the mid-60s. It was inconceivable back in those days that the world would be facing. What is now happening in the Pacific Ocean due to radioactive pollution spilling from Fukushima, or what is happening in the sky with particulate matter being discharged in the atmosphere, or what is happening in the food chain with the pollution of natural substances of nutrition, as well as the introduction of genetically modified substances, and so on and so on and so on. I'm not going to stand here and spend time in a NAV briefing reciting this catalog of horrors, which is well known to you all. But that catalog of horrors brings to mind the question, how much of the damage done to this planet already, as I speak today, January 2014, is irremediable by human agencies? The damage done by human agencies may be irremediable by human agencies. This very well may be the case. You know, I just heard today one of the experts, Busby, who talks about Fukushima, making this statement. When that event happened in 2011, 1 week from the inception of RESET, it was predicted not long afterwards that it would be in January 2014 that the pollution would massively reach the west coast of the United States. And so now a great deal of attention is going to the west coast of the United States, from Mexico, Baja California, all the way up the coast of California to Oregon and Washington, to determine what is going on as a cumulative and exponential result of the Fukushima contamination. And I think it would be safe to say that it looks like the Fukushima contamination of the Pacific Ocean is beyond human remedy. And that is an example of one of the wounds that hurt the mother. But the poster says, hurt the mother and the wounds she'll take. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that the planet Earth has a strong enough self-healing system? The planetary animal mother has self-healing powers that are strong enough for her to heal these wounds inflicted by human agents, which human agents cannot correct because they have escalated beyond the scale of correction. I don't know. We're going to see. One of the mysteries that comes out of the GNE and the 3-year period of RESET concerns what happened during the perigee hits in the Scorpion. Ha ha ha. Ha ha ha. Remember that subject, mateys. What happened in the perigee hits of the Scorpion? And into the tail of the Scorpion, the stinger, what happened? You will recall that I have said numerous times that it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the human mind to conceive what the Aeon Sophia is doing with the hits of her first attention. It is much easier for us to follow what she is doing with the hits of her second attention. Why? Because, as the sacred narrative says, Sophia herself gifted us with the luminous epinoia, which means the power of imagination on the level of the imagination of the aeons themselves. And since the second attention operates through memory and imagination, memory being a sub-function of imagination, because when you remember something, you simply imagine it. That being so, it is easier for us as human animals to follow and track and monitor and define and frame and apply the apogee hits in the constellations than the perigee hits. Deeply, deeply mysterious processes of terrestrial chemistry and biochemistry and geomagnetic alchemy are conducted with the perigee hits, and the navigator cannot even dig far enough into his own mind to produce the syntax for those developments. Also, I would point out that if you would wish the navigator to track those developments closely as they occur, then it would require the navigator to put on his Nahual hat and practice intense and systematic repeated sessions of telestic investigation in order to even get close to what the wisdom goddess is doing in these perigee hits. Well, nice work if you can get it. But I have not really had the opportunity to do that. Although I may have the opportunity to do so in the coming weeks, thanks to a generous donation. I may have the opportunity to do that in the coming 2 months, and therefore to tie together some intel, to bring together some intel about the perigee hits as we reach the conclusion of the GNE. Now let's consider the second part of the language on the poster. But hurt the child and Kali awakes. What does this simple phrase suggest? Well, I propose to you to consider that it might indicate that the wrath of the planetary animal mother would not be directed toward those who inflict wounds on her, but rather toward those who inflict wounds upon the children of the human species. Perhaps she can handle and heal the wounds that are inflicted on her natural body. We don't know. We'll see. But perhaps she can't handle alone and on her own the hurt that is done to the Anthropos, to that luminous child. And perhaps it is the hurt directed toward the child that awakens the rage of Kali. And if that is the case, I propose that you consider that the hurt that is done to the children of this planet is what awakens the will to avenge in the human animal. Now, in this case, of course, I'm not talking about an act of vengeance between one human animal and another. I'm not talking about a transaction between individuals, but I'm talking about a transaction between each human individual and those others among us who perpetrate this harm upon children. You will recall in the previous briefing that I made a distinction between the battle for the narrative, which is intellectual and ethical, and the identification of an issue of universal alarm that is capable of arousing mass empathy across the collective spectrum of society. Mass empathy focused on a particular issue, and that such a focus would then be, as it were, the channel for the will to avenge. You know, it's easy to make a catalog of horrors describing the perpetrations of certain human animals upon this planet, what I call the machinations, I never know how to pronounce it, the machinations of social evil. The work of the psychopaths and the predators is vast indeed. So pick your horror. Pick a card from the deck of horrors in Kali Yuga And what is the worst horror that you can think of? Well, different people are disposed in different ways to name the worst horror. For some of you, the worst horror might be chemtrails and Morgellons disease. For others, the worst horror might be the assault of Monsanto and the horror of GMO Frankenfoods. For others, the worst horror might be the silent weapons for a silent war. Have you caught that one yet? Go look it up. Deborah Tavares, Silent Weapons for a Silent War, is a manifesto from NASA and the secret government describing the complete destruction of the human mind by the use of microwave technology. I mean, get a load of that. That might be your favorite horror. Everyone has their favorite horror. And there are plenty of horrors to choose from, aren't there? And all of these horrors, bear in mind, are the consequence of human animals acting deliberately according to a particular agenda. The horrors of Monsanto are due to perpetrators acting on a particular agenda. The horrors of the fraud and extortion and theft of the international financial markets are the result of perpetrators, particular human animals. So there are whole groups of perpetrators out there that you as an individual might target with your will to avenge. If you want to avenge the destruction that has been done to world economy by London bankers, then you would direct your will to avenge to those individuals. Now, be sure to take note here that we are considering the application of the will to avenge toward those who have done harm, but not necessarily to you personally. So, of course, we're talking about contra-violence and the focus and implementation of transpersonal rage. But the will to avenge is the same instinct in the human animal, whether it is applied in a personal instance where you hurt someone who hurts you, or whether it is applied in a collective, transpersonal, and planetary instance where you go after someone who is hurting someone else. Now, since we're not talking about hurting the Earth here, let's concentrate in the final minutes of this briefing on how to apply the will to avenge to one particular horror taking place, unfolding day by day, massively across this planet. I propose to you that of all the horrors that one could choose, there is one ultimate evil on this planet, which is capable of provoking the greatest empathy among all human animals, regardless of their nation, their race, their language, or their religion. There is one issue of universal alarm I'm proposing that would be a focus in the human mind to look directly at the ultimate and supreme evil. And this would be, if this were possible, if this focalization of perception were possible, then the empathy of the human animal and the will to avenge would be directed in a most specific and rigorous way. And what I'm proposing is that this may be necessary as correction unfolds, that this may be the one necessary ingredient, along with others, but above and beyond all the others, that invites and excites the wrath of Kali. Hurt the mother and the wound she can take, and maybe heal for herself, we don't know, but hurt the child and see Kali awake. I refer again to my experiences in the recovery movement. As I said, during that time, those of us who anonymously shared our experiences of abuse and abandonment in childhood were mutually focused on the topic of child abuse, obviously. But our conception of child abuse at that time, from the mid-80s into the early 90s, was narrowly limited to child abuse in the family. Most of the testimonies in those rooms were of familial child abuse. Some of them extended into institutional situations where children had been placed in foster homes or institutions, and in some cases, sexual abuse undergone in the Catholic Church and so forth. But for the most part, our focus on child abuse was narrow. What I see now is a different view of child abuse that may come into focus in the immediate future. There have been attempts to bring this issue of child abuse before the world, and those attempts have been rigorously repressed. I will just cite quickly three examples of those attempts. The first one goes back to the 1990s, 1993 and 94, and that's actually a period of time I was researching when I came upon this theme recently. A British film crew came to the United States and made a film, a documentary called Conspiracy of Silence. You can find pirated copies of it on the internet. It was only shown 3 times in the United States and Britain, and scheduled broadcasts of it and promotion and exposure of the film was totally repressed. The second instance I lived through personally when I was living in Belgium in 1996, the Marc Dutroux affair. And there is also a documentary which gives a clear and informative account of this affair. And that I'll link you to that documentary, or I'll cite it in a future briefing. No, I can cite it right now. Here it is. In the YouTube search bar, write Scientology, the CIA, and MK Ultra, Illuminati Mind Control. Now there's a potpourri of wonders for you to digest. That will bring up a documentary about 55 minutes long, patched together from a number of different sources. And the middle part of that documentary covers the Marc Dutroux affair, the Marc Dutroux case, which I observed very closely during the time that I was living in Belgium, during the time that it happened. Finally, the third event of exposure of a massive pedophilia ring of child abuse has occurred recently in the UK with the Jimmy Savile affair. Now, Brian Gerrish on UK Column has reported on this scandal, as it is euphemistically called. It's a horror, should not be called a scandal. And he has shown how the BBC and other agencies in the media and the government have systematically played down and repressed this investigation. And he shows how they will not allow the public to know that the existence of such rings forms an intrinsic part of the way that government operates. You see, that is the incendiary point of this issue. That connection between a systematic network of child abuse and the control of people in power is a combination that can't be beat. There are many kinds of evil being perpetrated on this planet by human animals, but I designate this as the ultimate evil. Nevertheless, the opportunity to expose that evil could be the best thing that ever happened on this planet, because it would not only allow those who choose to do so to avenge the harm done to these children by doing harm to the perpetrators, but it would also allow the exposure of what makes corrupt government work. The corruption of government is part of the general corruption of human behavior on this planet. Granted, obviously. But there is a particular factor operating in the corruption of government. I ask you, what might happen if it comes to be known? Not only that these systematic and highly protected networks of child abuse exist, but more significantly, that they do not exist merely for the satisfaction of the perverts who harm and torture and murder children and film the murders. Not merely for that satisfaction, if you can imagine that there would be satisfaction and pleasure in that kind of behavior for some human animals. And there is. But more significantly, that those networks serve as a tool for control at the highest level of governmental and political power and influence. To me, this is a consummate proposition. There is nothing else quite comparable to it. There are many other horrors operating on this planet. But I would say, oddly, in concluding this briefing, that it might be this horror that in some way contains a key to solution. In correction, we want to be in solution, no longer just in the problem. The overview of the GNE that you have so far ought to show you that there are three critical years in human history which prepare humanity to face its problems. But once those years have transpired, the attention of human animals must be taken from the problem to the solution. And I propose that focusing on this issue and this concept of child abuse, which goes far beyond anything that we knew back in the recovery movement, is it defines the direction to be looking. So with that thought, I'll conclude this briefing. I must say, I feel better from having qualified and clarified some of the things I said in NAV Briefing 102. You know, my voice and the sound of my voice is the guiding signal of this experiment. I'm still alone. I'm still talking into an empty room here in my little navigator's cabin in Andalusia. How different it would be to be in the presence of some human animals while talking. I think you can easily imagine that. I would have the opportunity to adjust my tone, my modulation, to adjust my style, and adapt the subject according to the feedback coming from the eyes and the minds and words of my witnesses. But as it is, the only witnesses I have now are those of you who are in the audience of my Treya, my distant witnesses, my distant friends and allies, and I count on you to hold me to the same standard of correction to which I hold you.